rebelled against Imam Ali in the Battle of Nahrawan. These three groups of people came and they attacked Imam Ali, they fought Imam Ali and the Muslims. Thousands of people were killed, and several thousands actually were killed in each of these battles. And it is unfortunate that this happened amongst the Muslims when the caliph of the Muslims had been selected by the people and he was accepted by the people. Still, these groups went and fought and rebelled against the rightful caliph of the Muslims. But dear friends, by the grace and blessings of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, we find that Imam Ali, alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, was victorious in every single one of these battles, and he reached the highest of positions before these battles and after these battles. The people were not able to stop Imam Ali. And so, dear friends, we need to remember as a lesson here that despite the trials and the difficulties, if we remain steadfast upon faith, if we trust in Allah, if we rely in Allah, and we try our hardest, then no matter the odds and no matter how great the enemy and the opposition might seem, the party of Allah will surely be victorious. A beautiful, beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafi. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, I convey all this to you, lest inordinate desires, temptations, and inducement should start influencing you, or adverse changes of times and circumstances should drag your name in the mire, or I should leave you like an untrained colt, because a young and fresh mind is like a virgin soil which allows things sown in it to grow verdantly and to bear luxuriantly. Then, I have made use of early opportunities to educate you and train you before your mind loses its freshness, before it gets hardened or warped, before you start facing life unprepared for the encounter, and before you are forced to use your decisions and discretions without gaining advantages of accumulated traditions, collective knowledge, and experiences of others. These words of advice and counsels that I give you will save you from the worry of acquiring knowledge, gathering experiences, and soliciting advice from others. Now, you can easily make use of all the knowledge which men have to acquire with great care, trouble, and pain. patience. Things which were hidden from them and which only experiences and sufferings could bring to light are now made easily available to you through these exhortations. My dear son, though the span of my life is not as that of some other people who have passed away before me, yet I took great care to study their lives. Assiduously, I went through their activities. I contemplated over their deliberations and deeds. I studied their remains, relics, and ruins. I pondered over their lives so deeply that I felt as if I have lived and worked with them from early ages of history down to our times, and I know what did them good and what brought them harm.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir la'in ar-rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. And I would like to begin with this first question about Amir al-Mu'mineen. And the question about who is Ali is actually a very simple question. What I want to answer tonight is the question of what is Ali. There is a difference between who is Ali and what is Ali? And for this, I would like to go to a story narrated by Hakim Nishapuri. He actually talks about a hadith which has been quoted by many, many Sunni scholars, but only the last part, what the Prophet said Ali. But the preamble of that is only narrated by this fellow known as Hakim Nishapuri. Hakim Nishapuri was a scholar who came later on, and he was expert of Sahih Bukhari and Sahih Muslim. And he realized, you know, he studied the methodology of both of these scholars, Imam Bukhari and Imam Muslim. And he says that, I see there are many, many ahadiths that these two scholars have ignored. Although when I look at the methodology, it was necessary for them to include those ahadiths. So he wrote something known as Al-Mustadrak al-Sahihain. As a complement to Sahihain. Sahihain means Sahih Bukhari and Sahih Muslim. The ahadith which have been missing from those two books. And there he has a narration, and this is a narration which is considered by him to be Sahih, according to the standards of Imam Bukhari and Imam Muslim, and as well as other scholars of hadith who have come later on. They verify that this is a Sahih hadith. And what is the hadith? He says that the slave of Abu Zar Ghifari by the name of Abu Thabit, he narrates that he was with Ali bin Abi Talib on the day of Jamal in Basra. He says, when we gathered in the battlefield, both, you know, sides facing one another, he said, when I looked at the other side, I saw Aisha, Ummul Mu'mineen. And when I looked at her, confusion and doubt crept into my heart, the way it had happened to many people. You know, for us, it's very easy, coming centuries after the event, to study them, what happened before, what happened after, what happened within. So we know the context. And it's easy for us to make the judgment. But put yourself in the place of Abu Thabit. On one hand, he says it is the Prophet's son-in-law. On the other side, he sees the Prophet's wife. On another side, he saw the cousin of the Prophet, Abdullah ibn Abbas. On the other side, he saw another cousin of the Prophet, Zubayr. And so there was a lot of confusion. He was, you know, people were not that clear when they saw these personalities on both sides. But Abu Thabit says that by the time of Zuhr, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala resolved the doubt for me. And I was there steadfast on the side of Ali bin Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
13 days after breaking out from Gilboa Jail, Israel's maximum security prison, Ayham Kamamji and Munadal Infi'at were rearrested by Israeli forces during a military incursion into northern city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. Kamamji and Infi'at, both members of the Islamic Jihad movement, were the last of six Palestinian prisoners who escaped Gilboa prison on September 6. Like their fellow inmates, they were immediately taken to an unknown place for interrogation, and the Israeli authorities have extended their detention to continue the interrogation process. Palestinian Authorities Commission of Detainees Affairs held Israel responsible for their lives and said it's illegal to retry prisoners who are already serving sentences and life sentences.
Israelis are trying to cover up the scandal of the prison break. The prisoners who succeeded to flee were serving life sentences. Now, Israel's decision to extend their detention under interrogation serves only to soothe the public outrage on Israeli streets. We warn Israeli authorities against harming the prisoners, especially if they continue placing them in solitary confinement for lengthy periods after their interrogation.
The inmates were arrested after a large number of Israeli troops raided different parts of Jenin. Clashes broke out between Palestinians and Israeli soldiers in a number of locations, with stones and explosives thrown towards Israeli forces. A number of Palestinians were moderately wounded during the clashes, according to medics. Moreover, two Palestinians were arrested during the operation. The Israeli military claims they had helped Kamamji and Infi'at hide in Jenin.
Israel boasted of a security image, but it was tarnished by the Palestinian inmates' prison break. Now, even the rearrest of the last two inmates in Jenin cannot boost the image. The prison break was a great blow for Israel.
Last weekend, Zakaria Zubaydi, Mahmoud Arda, Mohammed Qadiri, and Mohammed Arda were captured by Israeli forces in and near Nazareth, northern the occupied lands. Their lawyers said the men have been subjected to physical and mental abuse and torture by Israeli interrogators, and each of them is placed in 2-by-1 square meter room lacking basic necessities for life.
Palestinians say Israel's security failure can never be rectified by the rearrest of the six prisoners or through the Israeli military operations across the occupied territories. They add the fact at the end of the day proves that the jailbreak has embarrassed Israel's security establishment. Mona Khandil, Occupy Ramallah.
The rearrest of the last two remaining Palestinian inmates who had escaped from an Israeli jail has sparked public outrage among the Palestinians. Palestinians have come together in the Gaza Strip to voice their anger at Israel's growing pressure on the Palestinian inmates.
We in the Gaza Strip stress that fight against the Israeli occupation will go on, and the rearrest of the inmates won't deter us from expressing our solidarity with them. The prison break of the Palestinian inmates has inflicted a heavy blow on Israel's image. The resistance front has vowed to set them free in the coming exchange deal. We will never forget this achievement.
Reports say the two men were caught alive in Jenin, their hometown in the West Bank, after they were surrounded by Israeli army.
We have come here to condemn the inhumane Israeli treatment of our prisoners. Our message to our inmates is that we will keep supporting them until they are freed. The international community has ignored the issue of Palestinian prisoners for years.
2 weeks ago, six Palestinian inmates caved through a dug hole in the floor of their shared cell, exposing deep security flaws of Israeli system. Palestinians held several rallies calling for ending the Israeli violation of prisoners' rights.
Palestinians will keep holding events like this to voice their support to our detainees in Israeli jails. Israeli regime should know that our prisoners are not alone and we view them as symbol of resistance. The international community should break its silence and expose the true nature of Israeli regime.
Thousands of Palestinians are held in Israeli jails, with hundreds of them under the practice of administrative detention.
Palestinians here stress the rearresting of two inmates who broke out of the Jilbo prison does not hide the fragility of the Israeli security system. Palestinians see this cave as a remarkable incident in the history of the Palestinian cause, demanding the international community to stop Israel's torture against detainees. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The serial killings of Iranian scientists must stop. This comment was made by families of the five slain nuclear scientists who were allegedly assassinated by Israeli agents. Now the households of the victims have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. for its support for Tel Aviv and what people here call terrorist activities against Iran.
I believe the reason that they did this in front of my eyes and my mother's eyes was to terrorize people. That's what terrorists do.
We have already gotten too late into this legal proceeding. They killed my husband 12 years ago, and I still feel the pain. It's not easy to forget such a great loss. The point is, America and Israel do not feel sorry for this, and that's why we ask Iranian and international judicial systems to bring the perpetrators to justice.
Iran does not recognize Israel as a country. This is why the case is not directly aimed at Israel, but is targeting the U.S. as a supporting force behind Tel Aviv. If succeeded, the move will lead to the freezing of American assets in foreign countries.
We are now waiting for the verdict of Iran's court for international affairs. We will follow up the case in countries that maintain judicial cooperation with Iran. There, we will demand that U.S. assets be blocked and transferred as compensation to the families of the victims. This is to remind the criminal governments that their crimes will not go unanswered.
Israel has a history of targeted killing of Iranian nuclear scientists since 2010. While Tel Aviv has not commented on any of the assassinations, its footsteps can be traced in all of the incidents. In this video, recorded in 2018, ex-Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gives the game away.
Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
Less than 2 years after this comment, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was a key Iranian nuclear scientist, was assassinated. Over the years, different American and Israeli officials have spoken openly about, quote, taking down the nuts and bolts of Iran's nuclear industry. The plaintiffs here say the U.S. was trying to do so by killing Iranian nuclear scientists, and today by enforcing the so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. But they say both measures have so far failed, and the West is now urging Iran to sit and talk about its nuclear program in Vienna to revive the 2015 nuclear pact.
Plaintiffs here hope that their lawsuit against the U.S. will break the chain of Washington's targeting of the Iranian scientific community. But they say the underlying messages are even more important, as the case lays bare the U.S.'s double standards with regards to human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In many cities in France, anti-health pass protesters marched again in what has become a weekly protest. They do not agree with the mandatory measures the French government has established to obtain much more vaccinations. But the protest movement is weakening a bit. Important figures of the Yellow Vests want to re-engage with the original inquiries of the movement, more social justice and against the authoritarian policy of the government. They want to elaborate a political force that will be able to influence the 2022 presidential elections.
Today we are with the angry citizens against the health pass, but as the Yellow Vest movement, we continue demanding more social justice and less taxes and a participative democracy.
70% of the French have received two jabs of the anti-COVID vaccine. Due to the health pass that people have to show in almost every public places, the virus is soon to be under control and life in France is slowly returning back to normal. The National Institute on Economic Studies, INSEE, announced that the French gross domestic product, GDP, will increase with more than 6% in 2021, after a fall last year of 10%. This is good news for the economy, except that workers' rights are deeply affected by the COVID crisis. More and more people lose their full-time contract, which is often transformed in variable working hours and a temporary contract, less paid, and most of all, offering less job security.
I am a volunteer worker. I see the misery. We distribute food. There is much more misery now, and more young people are in need.
During the lockdown, people with precarious contracts were affected the most. Today, the government of Macron is reforming the unemployment status. He makes the labor market very flexible. He takes advantage of this crisis to implement his antisocial policy.
French President Macron had once declared that an unemployed person just has to cross the street to find a job. For many people, this is only wishful thinking. The vaccination campaign is certainly successful in pushing back the COVID virus and putting the economy back on track. But the French population remains deeply divided about the mandatory health pass. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
One of the major border crossing points between Pakistan and Afghanistan. For decades, on an average, every day, tens of thousands of people have been making back and forth movements on both sides of 2,700-kilometer long porous border. After the return of the Taliban in Afghanistan, many Afghans are using Pakistan as a transit route to leave for Western destinations, given 70% unemployment in the neighboring country. However, weeks before and after the Taliban's takeover, the Western media have reported such routine traveling of Afghan citizens as being fresh influx of refugees into Pakistan.
This visit of
something the visiting UN High Commissioner have not denied to be the case.
The situation is better because there is no fighting. I have often been asked, is there big refugee movements? We have not seen big refugee movements, but of course, if the state collapses, we could see a lot of people trying to seek refuge in other countries. If the state ceases to function, this will provoke a crisis that is much bigger than humanitarian.
The UNHCR has reported nearly 500,000 internally displaced Afghan citizens inside Afghanistan. Their houses were bombarded by the US and the former Afghan Air Force during clashes with the Taliban in major urban centers like Kandahar, Herat, and Kunduz. Rest of Afghanistan largely fell to the Taliban after the US-trained Afghan army surrendered without any fighting.
We must make sure that displaced people can either go back to their homes, and some people are going back to their homes, or if they are displaced, they are under a shelter. And you know, many are not. Many are out in the open, sleeping rough.
Analysts point out that the real problem in Afghanistan is deteriorating economy, as Afghan financial system has been dependent at least 60% on foreign aid. With the change of guard in Kabul, the Western countries and the UN have resumed funding, which is far less than what the new government requires to stabilize the fragile economy. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
One of the world's largest democracies, and on the wall of the parliament, which represent democracy, there is a sentence which reads, Vasudeva Kutumbakam. It means the world is one family, and this is considered the most important moral value of the Indian society. But this is apparently not the case anymore, considering the growing discord in the society. In recent months, attacks against Muslim hawkers have come under the spotlight in social media. Critics say hate crimes against Muslims increased after the emergence of the Hindu nationalist government of the ruling BJP.
In India, from over close to a decade, the Muslim world community is being further marginalized. This is being done by boycotting the Muslim hawkers and small Muslim traders.
Experts say in India, the political notion has changed from a strong secular nation to a theocratic Hindu nation, which has given rise to violence against Muslims. Now, Hindu extremists have been busy running this show through social media. Experts say the country, which is apparently known as the world's largest democracy, is under grave danger of losing this title. In a nation of diverse ethnic and religious groups, now even beggars are being humiliated and intimidated just because of their faith and are asked to leave the country since they are Muslims. Based on reports by several rights groups, since the ruling BJP came to power in 2014, it has adopted various laws and taken actions that legitimize discrimination against the religious minorities and stigmatize critics of the government. Experts believe it could lead to instability in the world's most populous nation.
Everything is being done to further marginalize Muslims, including hate speeches, hate crimes, mob lynching, the citizenship law, criminalizing divorce, etc. Now they are picking on traders and vendors to weaken the Muslim community economically.
The ruling party of the Prime Minister Modi has fervently denied any discrimination against the community, saying India is a democracy and believes in equal rights for all. But critics say Prime Minister Modi's slogan of everyone together, development for all, and everyone's trust is nothing but a political tool to appease the voters as usual. Munawar Zaman, Press TV, New Delhi.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip took part in Friday prayer in front of the headquarters of the Red Cross. The event, organized by different Palestinian factions, aims to support Palestinian prisoners who are subjected to Israeli abuse.
We are here to stress that we will not disappoint our Palestinian prisoners and we will keep supporting them. Our prisoners are passing through difficult times inside the jails as the regime is attacking the prisoners, especially Islamic Jihad members.
Meanwhile, Palestinians consider the recent heroic escape operation of six prisoners from an Israeli jail as a slap in the face of Israel.
We are doing our best to release Palestinian prisoners, and this is an oath that we should stick with until all Palestinian inmates are free. We are working round the clock to hold meetings and put plans so we can liberate our prisoners and have them run us and with their families. Our resistance made a firm decision that the six Palestinian inmates that escaped Jilbo prison are on top of any coming exchange deal.
The Palestinian resistance mentors the behavior of the Israeli regime towards the prisoners inside the jails and those who remain free, demanding the international institutions to put pressure on Israel regarding the prisoners' issue.
The issue of our inmates inside Israeli jails is ongoing, and there are still two of the six heroic escapees out of the Israeli prison. We are here to express our total support for those inmates and all Palestinian prisoners who are fighting to achieve their demands.
Palestinians here stress they will remain committed to their duty of supporting prisoners and demanding their release. The issue of Palestinian inmates is a priority for Palestinians, who will keep demanding their release until they regain complete freedom. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Demonstrations have hit Aden and other cities in southern Yemen. The protests came in response to the deterioration of public services and widespread poverty within areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition's forces. But the demonstrations were met with a crackdown and resulted in deaths and injuries of protesters.
It is clear that the Saudi-backed regime has failed in handling of the economy, and this is what prompted people to go out and demonstrate in the southern governorates. The price of the dollar in Aden Biden is 2 times more than what it is in Sana'a. And this confirms that former future President Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi is implementing the agenda of the Saudi-led coalition, which seeks to control Yemeni lands and destroy the country.
The governor of Aden, Tariq Salam, said what is happening in southern cities is the revolution of the poor that will only end with the departure of all the forces of the Saudi-led coalition, including the Emirati-backed Southern Transitional Council, which controls the city of Aden.
Yemenis took to the streets of Aden to create a major popular uprising aimed at confronting the Emirati occupation authorities. And this is a result of the suffering experienced by the people of Aden due to the absence of public services, such as electricity, inflation, and high prices. This is the revolution of the hungry, and it will end when all the Saudi coalition's forces leave Yemeni lands.
6 years ago, the Saudi-led coalition occupied several cities in southern Yemen, including Aden. Since then, these areas have been paralyzed by a power struggle between the Saudi-backed Hadi government and the UAE-backed Southern Transitional Council.
The catastrophic situation in southern regions of Yemen has pushed people there to stage out and demand expelling the foreign powers. Observers say people have come to realize that the Saudi-led coalition's presence has only increased the misery in their country, where more than 20 million people rely on aid. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Since the beginning of the struggle for independence in Indian-controlled Kashmir in 1989, journalists in the troubled region have worked in dangerous conditions. The fraternity has often faced tremendous pressure from all sides, while many journalists lost their lives in the line of duty. New Delhi stripped Kashmir of its special status in 2019. Since then, the fraternity has accused the Indian administration in Kashmir of using intimidation, surveillance, interference and policing.
I think this is an attempt to treat journalists as enemy. The adversarial relationship that is there between the organs of the state and media as a fraternity is very adversarial at the moment, since last 2-3 years. And this is a result of, you know, when you treat journalists whose only job is to tell story and who are storytellers and who are not responsible for the story. They are treating, as we call the shooting the messenger.
According to the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, the freedom of speech and expression in Kashmir is under threat. Michelle Bachelet has also criticized India for pressuring journalists and frequent communications blackout in Jammu and Kashmir. However, India has often rejected any criticism relating to Jammu and Kashmir. Editor-in-Chief of Kashmirwala, an independent media outlet of Kashmir, says his organization has several police cases registered against them.
In the last 2 years, we have been multiple times called, summoned, questioned, interrogated or detained. And other than that, there are a lot of other things that happen behind the curtains. You get phone calls, you get people who meet you and they tell you that this thing should not be done, that should not be done. So that creates this sense of fear in you. You always have to look over your shoulder as a journalist at what is going to happen.
The new breed of journalists in Kashmir say journalism has been criminalized by authorities in Kashmir, and many of them, like Asif Amin, are being compelled by their parents to opt for other career options. Journalists in Kashmir say New Delhi is trying to control media outlets and newspapers. They say their career is in danger. But many analysts believe in an era that almost every individual owns a smartphone and has access to social media, controlling a narrative is impossible. Shahana Bhatt, Internet Minister, Kashmir.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
One of the seven Republican senators who voted to convict Donald Trump at his second impeachment trial warned on Sunday, 19th of September, that the former president's bullying of the party would lead to electoral defeat in next year's midterms and beyond. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Richard Luscombe. The piece is titled, "Republicans Who Let Trump Bully Party Will Seal Midterms Defeat," Senator says. One of seven Republican senators who voted to convict Donald Trump at his second impeachment trial warned on Sunday, 19th of September, that the former president's bullying of the party would lead to electoral defeat in next year's midterm elections and beyond. Republican Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana was speaking days after the Ohio Republican Congressman Anthony Gonzalez, who voted to impeach Trump over the U.S. Capitol attack, announced he would not seek re-election. On Saturday, 18th of September, another Trump critic in the House, Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, released a hard-hitting video statement in which he told colleagues, silent about the state of their party, the time for hiding is over. Republican Senator Bill Cassidy told NBC's Meet the Press, "Politicians are not victims. Politicians make a choice. If we choose to look forward, bringing positive solutions to the American people who have needs, we win. If we choose to be bullied, we lose." The two-term senator also appeared to reference an extraordinary letter sent this week by Donald Trump to the Georgia Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, demanding he decertify the illegitimate presidential election result. Joe Biden's win in Georgia is central to Donald Trump's big lie that the election was stolen. His previous efforts to overturn the result are the subject of a criminal inquiry. The broader question, frankly, is do Republicans continue to re-litigate 2020, or do we look forward with a positive agenda? Bill Cassidy said, "If we re-litigate 2020 over and over again, it won't change the result in 2020, but we're sure to lose in 2024. On the other hand, if we have a positive agenda which addresses the fact that the Biden administration is in disarray, whether it's inflation, the border, Afghanistan, then the country will win and will win. But if we choose to be bullied, we'll lose." Allies of Donald Trump have said they expect him to run for the White House again. Bill Cassidy's vote to convict him would have disqualified the former president from running for office again. It brought a fierce backlash from members of his own party and Donald Trump himself. But the Louisiana senator does not face re-election himself until 2026. Others who have spoken out have felt the wrath of Donald Trump and his acolytes, including Liz Cheney, the Wyoming congresswoman ousted as number three Republican in the House after voting for Donald Trump's impeachment, and also Anthony Gonzalez. Anthony Gonzalez, a 37-year-old former NFL player, said he was standing down to spend more time with his family. But he acknowledged that toxic dynamics inside his own party was also a significant factor. In a New York Times interview, Anthony Gonzalez said Donald Trump was a cancer for our country, whom he did not believe could ever be president again. He also dismissed Donald Trump's inevitable good riddance response, voiced in a statement on Friday. "I haven't cared what he says or thinks since 6th of January, outside when he continues to lie about the election, which I have a problem with," Anthony Gonzalez said. Senator Bill Cassidy would not be drawn on whether Gonzalez's departure was good or bad for the Republican Party. Anthony is choosing his personal priorities. You read his statement, it stands for itself, he said. But he stressed that the GOP was in dire need of a new direction. We answer to voters, and so if we don't answer to voters in a positive way, we lose, he said. If all you do is talk about the past, then you're yesterday's news. Meanwhile, the former Democratic Congressman Beto O'Rourke is set to mount a third campaign for major political office with a run for governor of Texas, according to the Axios website on Sunday. Citing unnamed Texas political operatives, the website Axios said Beto O'Rourke's challenge to the Republican Governor Greg Abbott would be announced later this year. A longtime advisor, David Weissong, told Axios, no decision has been made, but also said O'Rourke had been making and receiving calls with people all over the state. The Hollywood actor Matthew McConaughey has also flirted with challenge to Greg Abbott, a hardline Republican who recently stoked liberal outrage by signing into law new voting restrictions in Texas and the most severe abortion law in the country. Some Democrats fear a centrist run from Hollywood actor Matthew McConaughey could divide the anti-Abbott vote. Gilberto Hinojosa, chair of the state Democratic Party, told Axios website, we hope O'Rourke is going to run. We think he'll be our strongest candidate. We think he can beat Abbott. The 48-year-old Beto O'Rourke served three terms in the U.S. House from an El Paso district before resigning to run for Senate in 2018. Republican Governor Greg Abbott is running for a third term in office but looks vulnerable, particularly after presiding over a deadly failure of the state energy grid during a cold snap in February this year and opposing measures to combat COVID-19. Nearly 62,000 Texans have died.
Why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jalad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. This program, Islamic Laws, we are going to deal with the laws related to taqlid or following mujtahid. according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Well, Sheikh Javid, since we are talking about the laws related to taqlid or following a religious authority, let me start this episode with this question. You know, we all know that there are two kinds of people who are ignorant about Islamic laws or don't pay enough attention to the Islamic laws, all right?
Yeah.
Either they are innocent in their ignorance or they are really guilty.
Guilty.
All right? So could you shed some light or even give some examples about this so that our dear audience would know and understand the meaning of ignorance in the context of legal and Islamic laws or rules.
Thank you very much for the nice question. Well, as you rightly mentioned, there are two kinds of ignorant people when it comes to Islamic laws and mm-hmm. Legal rulings. The proper term to use is culpable ignorance mm-hmm. and inculpable ignorance, okay?
Right.
A person who is guilty mm-hmm. in his ignorance, he has, for example... Yeah, he has access to religious
yes.
authorities, he has access to the internet, to books and to Islamic material, and yet still he does not take any action to learn the Islamic law,
right.
and he continues to perform his prayers without even doing any research whether his prayers are valid or not, and he does actions which may be haram and which
right.
may be halal, but anyhow, he is guilty and he does not even make any efforts to improve his knowledge and his awareness about religious activities
mm-hmm.
and religious actions. So such a person is actually guilty, and we can say that his ignorance is culpable.
Right.
But when it comes to inculpable ignorance, that is a kind of ignorance out of innocence. Okay, innocence. So people want to know about Islam. They want to know about fiqh, about the Holy Quran, about tradition, but they have no means with which or through which they can actually learn or they can improve their awareness
mm-hmm.
or their knowledge of Islam. So just imagine there are people in the North Pole. These people are, let's say, Eskimos, okay?
Yes.
These are people who have no access to anything, and they do not have any idea about what Islam is or what religion is. Okay, they are cut off from the rest of the world, Okay.
So there is no cyberspace, no electricity, no nothing.
Maybe recently such things might be available.
Penetrated those places. Yes.
But even they do not have the knowledge, the know-how, the skill, because it needs some kind of knowledge.
Yes.
How to use such things. So these people are ignorant, and these ignorant people are inculpable. They cannot be punished even in the hereafter.
Yes.
According to Ayatollah Sistani, such people even do not deserve to be punished in the hereafter. Now, when it comes to giving you an example,
right?
I give you the example of someone, let's say, who masturbates in the month of Ramadan,
mm-hmm.
thinking that it's not haram, and he continues doing this. He does not perform ghusl. Now, if a person deliberately and knowingly does this, masturbates, he has to give the qadha of his fast.
In kafara.
And also he has to give the kafara.
Yes.
Because he has done it deliberately,
yes.
and intentionally. But if a person has been under the impression that masturbation is not haram, it is mm-hmm. not forbidden,
yes.
and he does it out of pure ignorance,
yes.
and he's not guilty in his ignorance, actually, such a person does not have to repeat his fast. His fast is valid, and the same person is not supposed to give any kafar.
Even his fast is valid?
His fast is valid, yes, of course.
Interesting.
According to Ayatollah Sistani. And mm-hmm. that's what we are trying to explain,
yes.
here in this episode. Yes.
I see.
Ayatollah Sistani says that he is not supposed to give the qadha of his fast. His mm-hmm. fast is valid in this supposition.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Nor does he give the kafara then.
Kafara is not obligatory either. Yes.
Okay. Let's take a break, if you agree, and we'll be back after a short break.
Sure.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Sheikh Javid, we are talking about the laws related to taqlid according to Ayatollah Sistani. Let me ask you this question. You know, we know that when children, in fact, become, or come of age and they attain puberty, in lots of other areas of life, they follow their elders, their parents. Is it necessary for these children who have attained puberty to follow a mujtahid whom their father follows?
Well, it's also an issue which needs to be discussed at length, at least. Children who attain puberty are not able to identify the most knowledgeable and the most qualified mujtahid. Even ordinary people who are adults,
mm-hmm.
who are even educated, who have gone to universities and schools and have acquired knowledge
mm-hmm.
of Islamic teachings, are not in a position to identify the most knowledgeable and the most qualified, or let's say the most eligible mujtahid, let alone children who have just attained puberty. So these people, of course, can receive or can get some advice from their parents, but they are not actually supposed to follow the same mujtahid whom their parents follow. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And of course, they can conduct their own research. They can do research about the mujtahid whom they follow. And of course, it's a difficult task. It's an uphill task. But if children come to know that a given mujtahid is more popular, more famous, and he is well known across the world, okay, that can be a reason to suggest that he could be the most knowledgeable person, otherwise he would not have been so famous across the world.
Mm-hmm.
So yes. Actually, a reputation, mm-hmm. reputation,
yes,
is according to Ayatollah Sistani, a reason with which one can convince himself or come to the conclusion through which that mujtahid is the most popular and the most eligible learned, learned scholar.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, how could such a mujtahid gain so much reputation?
Sheikh Javid, quite following the previous question that I asked you, how can a teenager, let's say a 15-year-old boy, identify or get to know the most learned mujtahid or religious authority? Don't you think that it's kind of difficult trying to find the most qualified mujtahid totally on his own?
Well, it has always been, and it still is an uphill task, as I said, for everyone, let alone children, let alone or teens who have just attained puberty, to identify the most learned and the most eligible scholar. But, you know, the religious authorities have put forth certain procedures and certain methods through which one can identify the most learned mujtahid.
Yes.
For instance, if two qualified scholars bear witness or testify to the effect that a certain mujtahid is actually the most learned mujtahid, that is sufficient, provided that those two scholars are not contradicted by other two scholars or three or more other scholars.
You
okay?
They come to a kind of unanimous agreement.
Sure, yeah. Okay, if two people who are qualified, not ordinary people in this state, okay,
mm-hmm.
two faqih, two jurists, bear witness that a certain mujtahid is the most qualified mujtahid, then that's sufficient. He can just act according to the testimony given by those two scholars.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.